We did a story about Nieto recently, and my mentions were just blowing up with people that were like, Long Beach native Matt Nieto. And I'm like, okay, there must be a joke there or something.
Thanks for checking out another cast from Teal Town, USA. Subscribe to our YouTube and SoundCloud channels or find us on iTunes for more Sharks content, including post-game, interviews, and our weekly wraps with the Pucknologist.
Good day, everyone. I am Chris. You can find me on Twitter at ChrisJWS. While you're there, be sure to follow Teal Town USA for great content, in-game gifing, post-games, and all that good stuff. Today, I am joined by Ryan S. Clark. We're going to talk about the Avalanche series with San Jose. It's coming up right now. He covers the Avalanche for The Athletic. Welcome in, Ryan.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really do appreciate it.
So these playoffs, they've pretty much gone exactly as you called it, right? I expect that's the case.
No one saw this coming. It's been such a strange postseason. And like you and I were saying before we started recording, when you think about it from the vantage point of the Avalanche, when the postseason began, there was a lot of balls in the air, the first one being the lottery. People thought with the Ottawa pick that came over in a Matt Duchene trade, could this be one, could this be two, Jack Hughes or Kaapo Kakko? It ends up being four. Then the next order of business is what comes up with Cale Makar, their top prospect. I mean, everybody knew he was going to leave after two seasons, but do you sign him now and burn a year of his contract and, you know you protect him for the expansion draft, or do you sign him for next year? Of course, he signs, and he's in the playoffs. Now he's played three games. But then the third thing was, what would happen in the first round against the Flames? Because it was sort of a tricky series in that, yes, Calgary was 3-0 during the regular season, but the Avalanche blew a 2-0 lead in game one. They blew a 4-1 lead in game two, and in game three, they were tied at two after the first period. So it wasn't like these have been blowouts per se, but they had been close. And so, yes, to see the way it's all played out, it's been strange given where the Avalanche started.
For sure. And I mean, right now it's hard to say who's going to win it all. I was just doing my second chance bracket. My first bracket is a complete wasteland. Even the second chance bracket, I really am not sure who to pick, because I could see almost any team left in the field winning it, because right, you know, there are no, this is a clear favorite, that's a clear favorite. In the series, there is no clear favorite, I would think, because the dominating performance that the Avalanche had over the Flames and San Jose slaying their dragon, so to speak, in Vegas, a team that gave them a lot of trouble for a long, you know, as long as they've been in the league for 2 years. So I'm not sure who to pick to win it all, because I could see every single team left possibly winning it. So let's just talk a little bit about that Avs Flames series. So game one went pretty badly for the Avs, but every game after that, you know, two OT games they won and two pretty strong games running away. You know, what was your perspective on the series going in, and how did you see it kind of evolve as it went?
Well, in terms of going in, one of the big questions was going to be for the Avalanche, the goaltending with Philip Grubauer. I mean, he had looked really strong over the final 5 or so weeks of the regular season in terms of when he received starts. But how is that going to work in the playoffs? Because you think about last season when he was with the Washington Capitals, he'd won the starting job, but Columbus really exposed him in those first two games before the Caps returned to Braden Holtby and, of course, went on to win the Stanley Cup. But you look at how well Philip Grubauer played. He matched Mike Smith save for save, so that was one element. The second one was what was going to happen in the sense of, truthfully, secondary scoring, because when you look at kind of the Avalanche this whole year, they've been really predicated around Gabriel Landeskog, Nathan MacKinnon, Mikko Rantanen. There's been some secondary help from other players like Carl Soderberg. And we saw Tyson Barrie at bits and in terms of the season look strong and engaged, and other times he wasn't there. But really, once Gabriel Landeskog went out, you saw 12 different players on this roster score goals, not named Mikko Rantanen or Nathan MacKinnon. And we saw that continue against Calgary. And really the third thing was, is just, could this team play a consistent game? Because even when they went 8-0-2 to get into the playoffs before they played the Sharks and lost in game 82, they had looked strong, but they hadn't put together a consistent game. And that, again, is something that we saw with this team do when they played the Calgary Flames.
For sure. And we'll talk a little bit about that forward depth, because I know the accusation I've heard several times that I don't think actually, at least not in the Calgary series, that really stands up is that it's a one-line team. You know, the closer I've looked at it, because, you know, I'll admit I was a lot more emotionally invested elsewhere while that series was on. So I wasn't watching super closely, but all the things I've looked at since then have indicated to me it's definitely not a one-line team.
Certainly not. And, you know, early on, that was sort of the narrative, and with good reason, because this was a line that was playing, you know, upwards of 20 minutes each. They are all on the first team power play. They were sort of driving things. As the secondary scoring was trying to figure itself out, there'd be games when it was there. There'd be games when it wasn't, sequences when you saw it, sequences when it disappeared. And now what you're seeing is this secondary scoring not only, you know, carry over from what it did in those final 11 games in the regular season, but you're seeing it now in greater context. So when you just think about this team, I mean, Tyson Barrie was third with 5 points, and those were all assists, which one of the things he did over the final stretch was score goals. I believe the number was he had 8 goals in the last 15 games, which was more than what he had in the first 62 of the season, just to give you an idea of how much of a turnaround that was. Colin Wilson is known for being a playoff performer, and he has 4 points in 5 games. Matt Nieto, which I'm sure no one in San Jose knows who he is, he had 4 points in 5 games. Of course, his 2 goals being shorthanded. JT Compher, 3 points in 5 games. Ian Cole, 3 points in 5 games. Eric Johnson, 2 and 5. And then, of course, Cale Makar with 2 and 3. And while Alexander Kerfoot only had an assist in those 5 games, the way he's played with McKinnon and Landeskog is what really allows Jared Bednar to put Mikko Rantanen on that second line with Colin Wilson and Carl Soderberg to give that second line not only a lot of size, but really a lot of strength and ability that can work in the corners for possession and just, again, spread out that scoring in the sense of having more than just one line who can really create on offense.
So you did mention Matt Nieto there. So do you happen to know where he's from?
I'm going to go on a limb and say Long Beach, and I'm going to suggest they call him Long Beach native Matt Nieto, which I'm curious because I've seen that on social. I take it that's something that would be said during broadcast, or where does that come from?
I believe that originates from Randy Hahn, the Sharks broadcaster, who said it quite frequently for the years he was here, and it more or less just became a meme that had a life of its own where anytime he got mentioned, it would immediately be, oh, Long Beach native, indeed.
No, fair enough, just because we did a story about Nieto recently, and my mentions were just blowing up with people that were like, Long Beach native Matt Nieto, and I'm like, okay, there must be a joke there or something, so good to know.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I feel a little bit bad for you. You could probably just mute the word Long Beach for a little while there. Staying with the forwards, so one of the things that popped out to me from that series also was Johnny Gaudreau, 99 points in the regular season, 1 point in 5 games. How did that happen?
Couple things. The first is the matchups the Avalanche were able to play with this checking line of Carl Soderberg, Colin Wilson, and at times Mikko Rantanen was a big factor, but also it's just the versatility of Jared Bednar really allowed those lines to just work well. So if he wanted to pair Carl Soderberg with Nieto and Matt Calvert, which they were a formidable checking line at times throughout the season, they could do that. And then the other thing too was just, it was the defense that they played, and it was who they were able to use in the sense of Eric Cole, Ian Johnson. I mean, yes, it was more of a collective effort, but Ian Cole and Eric Johnson, but between Eric Johnson, Ian Cole, and Carl Soderberg, those were really kind of the three drivers of the people who kind of took Johnny Gaudreau out of it from an offensive standpoint. And yes, there's the scheme in which the Avalanche run, but it's also the ability that those three bring, because Ian Cole is 6'1", 220 pounds. Eric Johnson, 6'4", 220 pounds. Carl Soderberg is 6'3", 210. Now, these are all players that have size, which that's a benefit against the 5'9", 167 Johnny Gaudreau. But the other thing that they have that a lot of people may not is they have the sort of skating and technical ability that allows them to keep up with someone like Gaudreau in these tight spaces, in these areas where he's been able to really elude others and just kind of wreak havoc. And so it's because of that tighter checking and these larger frames and just the overall scheme the Avalanche ran, that's what they were able to do to really take someone like Johnny Gaudreau and really that whole first line of Elias Lindholm and Sean Monahan out of the equation for the Calgary Flames.
So the other thing that popped out to me, besides shutting down Gaudreau effectively, was also, you already mentioned Grubauer, outstanding numbers by him. I mean, he posted nearly 94% save percentage, facing about 30 shots a game. That's pretty dang good. Even strength, 96%. So very strong overall, high danger, very good numbers. Same with all, you know, pretty much every possible breakdown you can have, pretty good across the board. If there's a matchup that in this that I'm really concerned about, is definitely going to be Jones versus Grubauer, because I'm sure if you even watched a little bit of the San Jose series, you know Martin Jones was definitely a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde, whereas Grubauer was very consistent throughout that series.
Well, you know, that's, I think, kind of been the interesting thing, you know, looking at Martin Jones, is it's not even just these playoffs, but it's kind of been, honestly, this season. People have kind of wondered, how consistent could Martin Jones really be for this team? And when you look at that playoff series against Vegas, I mean, of course, there are times when you just looked at Martin Jones and you just wondered, okay, what was this team going to be? Because let's look at his regular season numbers. Yes, he wins 36 games, but his goals against average is .294. His save percentage is .896. I mean, these are not the numbers you look for in a number one goaltender, whether it be with someone of Martin Jones's caliber or just someone who is a number one goaltender for a team that people think could win it all. And then when you look at the postseason as well, especially when you think about, you know, what he did in 2015-16 and again in 17-18. So let's look at 2015-16. 14 wins, 2.16 goals against, .923 save percentage. You look at last postseason, 6 wins, 2.26 goals against average, .928 save percentage. This year, a .320 goals against average, a .904 save percentage. I mean, that's a massive worry. And it's an even bigger worry when, like you said, it's the juxtaposition of Philip Grubauer, who has not only looked well, but he's looked like one of the strongest goaltenders in the league. And so if you're the Sharks, one of the things that they've done better than anyone you could argue this season in the NHL, maybe with the exception of Tampa Bay, and even then, it's not like it's that far of a gulf, is they can move the puck exceptionally well. And Jared Bednar talked about that today at practice by saying, you know, look, what the Sharks do on that end, it is elite. And something that we saw teams do in the beginning of the season, especially Columbus, was they were able to test Philip Grubauer's lateral movement, and they were just able to get goals and get really strong scoring chances that left him in a tough position. But one thing that the Avalanche have seen from Philip Grubauer over this run is his lateral movement, which is actually one of his strengths, has improved to the point where it is becoming something where it's harder to beat him. And so there's two examples. Let's use what happened the last time they played the Winnipeg Jets in February. If you look at what Winnipeg did that game against Philip Grubauer, they were able to test the lateral movement. They were able to pull off shots, whether it be these one-timers from different areas or just getting a really good position that left him with little reaction time to get in front of the puck. And it placed him in a compromising position. And it also didn't help that the defensive positioning too was off in those games. Now let's fast forward to the win they had against Minnesota. I believe it was I want to say Philip Grubauer had, like, I think, a 3-1 win. I mean, I can't remember. It's been so long ago. So I apologize. Yes, it was a 3-1 win on March 19th. And so with that game, you saw Philip Grubauer not only track the puck with his eyes and with his head, but his lateral movement was such to where his positioning was much stronger. The puck was behind the net. He was already on his knees with his eyes and his head kind of wrapped around the post, kind of following where it would go. And he set up his legs to the point where his legs were damn near touching each post. So in the event someone tried to wrap around, or no matter what position they were going to go to, if he needed to go from left to right, he could push. If he needed to go from right to left, he could push off. And those have been the things that he has done to not only improve his play, but really give the Avalanche the sort of player that honestly has just been really one of their driving engines, not just with this run against Calgary, but really over the last 5-6 weeks.
I think Sharks fans know very well the Sharks are very good at moving the puck. It's just usually shooting the puck at some point there. They make a few too many extra passes, but they can certainly move the puck around, and I expect that's something we will see no matter what. Looking at the matchup, I think a big part of what will help them would be to make sure they're getting shots on him, because I'm not saying he didn't face that many shots, but I looked at, you know, how many like danger zone type chances the Avs are giving up, and they're actually one of the best teams in the first round at limiting the really dangerous shots that he faced. And, you know, I thought the tail of the tape said something very similar, not just the numbers, that I think they were very effective at setting him up for success. So I think that's a big key for the Sharks, I think, is peppering him with shots, because I know they can definitely put up more than 30 a game. They can put up 35, 40, 45 shots a game sometimes, and really, you know, make him move make him work for it, because I think that's what they have to do. That's part of their identity. I think that's probably their best means of going after him.
I mean, that's certainly going to be key, is just how do you utilize that passing? Because it was the most recent game and the first game the Avalanche played at the SAP Center this year, where you just look at the passing and it's like, wow, this is what sets this team apart. And it's the different sort of combinations that the Sharks can play that really made them not only such a fascinating team to watch, but one you just look at if you're a goaltender and realize there's a lot of moving parts when it comes to just how you evaluate and play this team. Because again, yes, you have to worry about the puck moving defenseman like a Brent Burns and an Erik Karlsson, but then you have to worry about these forwards like Joe Thornton, Logan Couture, Evander Kane. I mean, the list just kind of goes on and on, in the sense of just players who can not only create goals for themselves and others, but really they can get shots on net too. And so, yes, to your point about maybe there's overpassing, sure, but at the same time, I mean, it's something that, again, it's a lot of moving parts for any goaltender. And so what they're able to do in the net front is really going to be key. And that's something Jared Bednar touched on again today, was just when you think about what San Jose does well, it is the net front. And as we saw in that overtime game with the Capitals and the Hurricanes, one of the things that Carolina did so well was they were able to utilize the net front. And also, they were able to do that because of how strong the forecheck was. And again, this time of year, the net front is where you're able to get so many goals if you're willing to work for it and get in the right position. And when you look at the way San Jose is built, they are constructed to do just that.
So on the other end, how do you expect them to go about attacking San Jose as far as getting their own offense going? Because I know while San Jose has great offensive defensemen, the defensive aspect is sometimes a little questionable. They have some solid guys. Obviously, Mark-Edward Vlasic's a big name that will always come up. Brendan Dillon's been a great 200-foot player. Burns definitely can be a little bit of a liability. Karlsson, we're pretty sure he's playing injured, has definitely not been the sharpest defensively. So there's definitely something there that I would expect Colorado could attack.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things that Avalanche could do is try to replicate what they did against the Flames games 2-5, which was just getting these copious amounts of shots on nets. We're talking about upwards of 45, 50. I mean, San Jose is the kind of defense that, again, it'd be hard to say there's going to be that many shots on goal, but you want to try to replicate that. But not only just try to replicate that, but you also want to move the puck around as well, and really try to not only just facilitate offense, but one of the things the Avalanche want to use, and I know it's certainly been talked about, is for as gifted as San Jose is, A, how do you take advantage of a team with short rest? And B, when you have some of those older skaters on ice, which again, people make it sound like it's this wide gulf in age. It's not that wide, at least, you know, one would not think, but it's just how do you move them around? And that's what goes back to someone like Joe Thornton, which, you know, again, we look at him and you wonder how at his age he's managed to, you know, really stay strong in today's NHL, where it's built around youth and speed. And like Jared Bednar said, it's about his brain and how he thinks the game and moves the puck. And with the Avalanche, those are things you need to do. I mean, you need to be intelligent with your puck play. You need to be able to use this skating prowess, which you've been constructed on, to really just try to outskate and really just overpower teams in that regard. But also, it's just trying to get shots where you can, because kind of like what you're saying about the Sharks, yes, that's a team that can overpass, but you look at the Avalanche on the power play, there have been moments when fans have booed at Pepsi Center because they've grown impatient for a shot. So really, it's going to be some of those things the Avalanche need to work on as well.
That sounds vaguely familiar. I've been...
But you can also a lot of teams are like that, because this funny anecdote real quick. So when the Avalanche played the Carolina Hurricanes, I mean, the Hurricanes, I think, had a like 44 shots on goal, something insane like that. And this was early in the season. And the Hurricanes were moving the puck around on the power play, and they must have gone what felt like 45 seconds without getting a shot on net, Chris. And the way the press box sit at PNC Arena, like, you can hear fans, some of them are pretty close to you, maybe not next to you, but just close enough. And you heard this one guy scream at Justin Falk, "Justin, shoot the damn puck." And it's like, all right, I guess we're that lit here in Carolina. So I think that's every fan base to a certain degree.
Oh yeah, no, I know. There's also the shoot it guy who literally there is no shot there, but he, you know, they say shoot it all the time. So I just looking at the, you know, the matchups this season, honestly, there was not really much I could take away from, you know, reviewing the score sheets, reviewing some of the highlights. I didn't really see anything that stood out to me. The only thing that really stood out to me from the matchups between the Sharks and the Avalanche this season is that the Avs can strike fast and the Sharks have to not get, you know, they could get a 3-goal lead or more. They can't sit on it because I believe it was in January. They went up 5-1. Avs made it interesting late. That's really the only takeaway I could find because not a lot really stood out to me about those games.
You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, even when you think about that most recent game, I mean, yes, the Avalanche's fate as well as the Sharks was already kind of decided in terms of knowing where they were going to be, and not saying that that's an excuse, but at the same time, it's going to be so much different than what we're going to see at least over the next four games. But, you know, really, when you think about just where these teams were at those points in the season, I mean, let's look back at that 5-4 game in terms of where they each were. I mean, the Sharks were a team that just everybody looked at them and thought like, okay, they're going to be the ones, or at least in that conversation, to challenge Tampa for the Stanley Cup. Whereas if you look at the Avs, I mean, they were going through this sort of weird stretch where people were wondering, how do you get to this hot start, only to let it slip away. Then let's go back to March 1st. At that point in the year, the Sharks were 38-19 and 8 with 84 points. They win 4-3. The Avalanche are 28-25 and 12 on 68 points. And again, it's that whole, how does this team go from being so hot at the start to slumping, and people wondering, was the slump the new normal, or was the beginning of the season new normal? They just can't figure out how to get there. Whereas if the last game, it's like, you know what each team is. But like we said earlier, you think about just the way this season series went. Yes, the Sharks won 3-0, much like the Calgary Flames did. And we saw how that turned out for the Flames and the Avs in round one. So to see what this is going to be fascinating, because to your point, it's almost like we've not really seen these two teams play consistent 60 minutes against one another. And it feels like you're going to see that throughout this series. And whatever comes of it, it's going to be anyone's guess, because like we alluded to earlier, I mean, trying to pick who's going to win a playoff series this year, it's really a fool's task. It really and truly is.
Yeah, I know my second chance bracket is probably going to be just as bad as my original one. I appreciate the NHL's thinking of that, but it's probably going to be just as bad. We'll have a third chance bracket probably in the finals. or excluding goaltenders, who do you pick on each side? Who are kind of your key players for San Jose and for Colorado? Which players stand out to you as the keys to the series for each?
Tell you what, before we get into key players, let's look at this matchup. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with Evander Kane and Nikita Zadorov whenever they're on the ice, just because Evander Kane is someone who, he is a tough forward who can do a lot of things. And Nikita Zadorov is the sort of defenseman that looks for the big hit to not only get himself going, but this team going. And what we saw from him against Calgary is exactly what they wanted when they brought him in the Ryan O'Reilly trade. So to see what happens between those two, it's going to be really, really fascinating. Now, as far as matchups, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what San Jose's defense does against Nathan MacKinnon, just because, again, looking at what Calgary did or didn't do, I mean, he was one of the strongest performances in the first round. So just to see what the Sharks are going to do in that regard is going to be interesting. But also, it's really just going to be fascinating to see, again, just kind of what happens in these battle of puck-moving defensemen with Burns and Carlson, along with Barry Girard and Cale Makar, especially because Greg Carville, Cale Makar's coach, who coached Eric Carlson in Ottawa for 2 years, says, look, Makar is the next Carlson. So it's just going to be interesting to see how that parallel works. But in terms of another matchup to really look at, it's going to be Jones and Grubauer, because, again, you're looking at one goaltender that people are kind of wondering, okay, will he figure it out this round, versus another goaltender, which a few months ago, the running joke in Denver has been, okay, go to February. Will Philip Grubauer see the light of day? Now it's, will Philip Grubauer be the starting quarterback for the Denver Broncos? So what happens with Jones and Grubauer is really going to be something to look for.
Yeah, I believe pretty much, and I said this before the Vegas series too, as Jones goes, so will the Sharks. Like, they can't win without him, and luckily he got it together just in the nick of time for them to win that first round series. Like, literally, if he'd waited 1 second longer, probably would not have been good. I know it is a fool's errand, but do you have a prediction? How do you think this series will play out?
The prediction is some fan base is going to be angry. To be serious, no clue. Absolutely no clue. And a lot of that just goes back to what we said earlier about when you watch these three teams play, you haven't really seen a consistent 60 minutes from each of them in that regard. So to see what San Jose does in a second round series against the Colorado team that has appeared to find its identity, that's what's going to be fascinating. And because of that, I mean, who knows? Let's just say this. If it was a sweep, I think people would be surprised. But if it was a seven-game series, no one would be surprised. So at this point, it really is anyone's guess. If we're going to be honest, the person who's going to win all this, it's going to be NBC, because they're going to find a way to keep people up really late at night to watch what could be one of the more fascinating second-round series of these postseason playoffs.
Absolutely. And my prediction, well, I'm still trying to figure out my prediction, but I'm feeling Sharks in seven, but I also said that before Vegas, and that was more like, that was my heart speaking. But you know what? I think it will be a good series, because the Avs definitely have some of the things that can give San Jose fits. As you said, though, San Jose can definitely do the same to the Avs as far as being able to pass and bring some a different type of game than Calgary does. So I think no matter what, it's going to be an interesting matchup. And I'm hoping that Good Jones shows up. If Good Jones shows up, I think this could be a great series. I mean, we had that epic a few nights ago against Vegas, and that was, I don't know if you watched that whole thing. I was screaming and waking up my wife and all that until the very end, because, well, she went to bed thinking that the Sharks are probably going to lose, and saw how that worked out. So it's hard to predict, and we'll see, but I think it'll be a great series. So with that, I'll start wrapping up here. If you just want to plug anything you're doing, any work you're doing, and just drop your Twitter handle or wherever people can find you.
Sure. Well, if people are bored enough to follow me on Twitter, it's Ryan_S_Clark. And then as far as some of the things that we're working on, I mean, let's just say there's certainly some big picture stuff that we do have coming down the pike. But in terms of just things that we've done, I mean, of course, we've kind of looked at some of the different things going with the Avalanche, such as, you know, okay, 2 years ago, this was a team that had one of the worst records in NHL history, the worst record in the salary cap era. Now, all of a sudden, they're a team that looks like they're competing for, again, to be something serious. And in a few years, a Stanley Cup playoff contender, in the sense of just how do you win it all? So really the big question that we looked at is, can you officially shed the rebuilding label from this team? But then another story that we did too, as we were alluding to earlier, we did something on Matt Nieto, and not just Matt Nieto, but Matt Nieto's sister. So long story short, his sister Erin is 19. She has Down syndrome and she has autism, and she's nonverbal. So she has a range of 20 words that she can say. And so I spoke with their mother, Mary, she was fantastic. And she said, you know, of the words that she can say, one of them is her brother's number 83, which is why Matt Nieto will never change his number. So we have all those things and more on The Athletic. So feel free to read. And also, yes, feel free to read Kevin Kurz, whoever that guy is. I'm joking. I love Kevin.
Oh yeah, we love Kevin over here. We know him quite well. I'm a subscriber to The Athletic. Honestly, if anyone out there is listening and they don't subscribe to The Athletic, it's well worth it. It's really, really good content and no ads popping into your browser. It's really great. So with that, my name is Chris. You can find me on Twitter at ChrisGWS. Please follow us also, Teal Town USA on Twitter. Thank you very much.